From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Robert Kotlowitz discusses his experiences as a college student who was drafted into the infantry in 1943 and sent to the French countryside to fight the Germans. His platoon, dug in 200 feet from the Germans, was ordered to attack. Surrounded on three sides by the enemy, with no artillery support, nearly his whole platoon was killed. Kotlowitz's World War II memoir has just been published in paperback. Then linguist Jeff Nunberg talks about new words like rockumentary and infotainment, words that combine parts of two old words. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat agreed today to take 2 weeks to consider a request by Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak to delay implementation of the Y River Peace Accords. The two leaders met today for more than 2 hours. Before the meeting began, the Palestinians stressed their position that Israel must carry out the troop withdrawals promised in the agreement and release hundreds of Palestinian prisoners from jail. Barak wants to delay any troop pullback that would leave Jewish settlements isolated in the middle of Palestinian-controlled areas. President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore stepped up their attacks on the Republican tax cut plan today, saying it would force deep cuts in popular programs and do nothing to preserve Medicare and Social Security. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
At the White House, President Clinton was accusing the Republicans of favoring risky tax cuts over strengthening Medicare and Social Security. At the Capitol, Vice President Al Gore repeated the White House message. Democrats are for Medicare. Republicans would put it at risk.
The American people, regardless of what political party they happen to be in, support Medicare. But the Republican leadership is beholden to a whole big group of special interests that want to use the money in the surplus for other purposes.
But Republicans say they are just trying to return the surplus to the American people in the form of tax cuts. Debate on their plan in the Senate begins tomorrow. It's expected to pass with some Democratic votes. The president has threatened to veto the bill if it comes to his desk. Mara Liasson, NPR News, the White House.
The leader of Yugoslavia's Democratic Party, a main opponent of Slobodan Milosevic, must report to a military judge tomorrow on charges of dodging the Yugoslav draft during the Kosovo crisis. NPR's Sarah Chase reports from Belgrade.
Zoran Djindjic, who was a ringleader of huge opposition protests 2.5 years ago, is answering a military court summons for not reporting for duty during NATO bombing. He left Belgrade 6 weeks after the airstrikes began and says he never received a call-up notice. The military court has served 2,400 criminal indictments for draft evasion. Some defendants have already been tried and convicted. Bucking a tide of patriotic enthusiasm at the beginning of the war, thousands of young men, most opposed to Milosevic, refused to report for military duty. A human rights lawyer here said today 23 to 28,000 may face charges. She said an amnesty for them should have been included in the pact ending the conflict between NATO and Yugoslavia. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Belgrade.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 116 points today to close at 10,979. Advances led declines by a small margin in moderate trading. This is NPR News. Coast Guard officials say they've rescued all 94 passengers from a cruise ship that struck a rock this morning in southeast Alaska. At least 20 of the 26 crew members also left the ship. The 192-foot Spirit of 98 ran aground in the mouth of Tracy Arm, a popular sightseeing destination about 40 miles southeast of Juneau. A Coast Guard spokesman said there were no reports of injuries and no pollution so far. 6 crew members stayed on board in an effort to save the ship, but the Coast Guard said flooding was out of control. As parts of the nation's midsection and eastern seaboard are drying out under intense summer sun, parts of the country that were threatened by drought are getting some relief, but too much rain is falling in parts of Arizona. Mark Moran from member station KJZZ reports from Phoenix.
Monsoon season storms have drenched parts of southern Arizona with torrential rains. 3 inches of rain fell near Tucson. Storms knocked out power to about 2,000 customers in the city. Flash floods ravaged the border town of Nogales, Arizona. On the Mexican side of the border, a 10-year-old boy was swept down a rushing stream. He's still reported missing. 35 people had to be rescued from surging floodwaters in the streets of Nogales. The American port of entry there was closed for a time as 2 to 3 feet of water submerged the roadway. Water has also made bridges unsafe for travel, and trains have been delayed. The storms have put an end to one of the driest years this century. Drought had created a severe wildfire danger and made ranching difficult. For NPR News, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
In stocks, the NASDAQ Composite Index gained 60 points to close at 2,679. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many people who didn't get to talk to their fathers or grandfathers about serving in World War II are now reading books about the war to help them understand the experience. My guest, Robert Kotlowitz, is the author of a World War II memoir that recounts his experience as a college student who was drafted into the infantry in 1943. He's Jewish and was sent to France to fight the Germans. In one battle, nearly his whole platoon was wiped out. He'll describe that experience in a few minutes. Kotlowitz's memoir, Before Their Time, has just been published in paperback. It was described by Paul Fussell in the Washington Post as an extraordinarily intelligent memoir. Kotlowitz is former managing editor of Harper's Magazine and former director of programming and broadcasting for the New York public TV station WNET. In 1943, after basic training, Kotlowitz was sent with the 26th Division to the French countryside.
I was sent to the Alsatian countryside because I had been what was called an ASTP infantryman. In the summer of 1943, about 175,000 18-year-olds were drafted out of college and given basic training primarily at infantry centers like Fort Benning, where I had been sent. And after 13 weeks of basic training, I was sent off to the University of Maine in Orono to study engineering, along with 1,000 other 18-year-olds. And within 2 months, that program folded, and lo and behold, the Army had 175,000 infantry-trained 18-year-olds to fill in divisions that were below strength. We went to the 26th Infantry Division, which was the New England National Guard, and then shipped to Europe in August of 1944, about 8 weeks or so after D-Day.
And what was your mission in the countryside?
The mission in the countryside was to simply rest, bivouac, until the new Ninth Army was formed, of which we were to be a core division, along with other divisions that were arriving and bivouacking exactly as we were. And we were there for 3 weeks or so, and suddenly the orders were changed, and we joined the Third Army in Alsace-Lorraine, which was General Patton's army. And the Third Army had broken out of Normandy. It was primarily an armored division group. And those armored divisions had run out of fuel and food and were now stuck in foxholes in Alsace. So they shipped us out. We relieved the 4th Armored Division, moved into their foxholes, and there we were.
I want you to describe what it was like for you to be fairly new in the war and living in a foxhole.
Well, the first thing was that it was very scary. I mean, it was not the first time I had lived in a foxhole. Training in the States tended to be as realistic as possible, so the physical aspect of living in a foxhole and dealing with the daily filth, the ordinariness of it, I was familiar with. What was new, of course, and what was threatening was that we were facing German troops across a no-man's land that was perhaps 200 yards wide, if that. It was a very static period in the war, not unlike World War I. And the tension that built up by just staying in a foxhole and unable to get out unless you were called for night patrol or were sent back for food and ammunition to replenish what you didn't have, that tension was really awful. And as a kid, I was really very scared.
You describe how the Germans would taunt you through a megaphone. So what were some of the things they would say?
Well, they would first tell us that Franklin Roosevelt was a Chew, as they called it, C-H-E-W. And they would tell us that New York had been flattened by German bombers and Seattle wiped out by Japanese bombers, and that the Statue of Liberty had been sunk, and, you know, things like that. Things that you knew immediately were hilariously false. And that had no effect on us at all.
How are you given orders to get out of your foxholes and attack the Germans who are about 200 feet away?
Well, you receive orders always at night. So whoever is carrying the orders, usually the squad leader, can reach each of the foxholes in which his men are occupying. And he tries to do it before dawn, before there's any light at all, so he won't be caught out by German snipers and riflemen. And so he can get back to his own foxhole in time to lead whatever has to happen in the morning.
And what did you think of the orders?
Well, I knew there were going to be orders like that at some point. I mean, we had been occupying foxholes facing a kind of series of small rises in which we knew the Germans were somehow hidden in their foxholes. And we knew that at some point we would have to try to take those rises because they made a kind of thumb sticking out of the lines. In other words, if you can imagine two straight lines facing each other with the opposite line bulging towards our direction, that would have been those rises. And we knew that at some point we would have to try to take it because it was too much of a threat to us to have that sitting there. But when we actually did get the orders, I mean, my mind was not working rationally at all. I was just instantly paralyzed with fear. And by the time we gathered to make the move out, I was going through the motions in a kind of automatic, robotic way, you know, depending upon my training, trying to stay alert to what the situation was and hoping not to get killed.
What happened in the first few seconds when you and the rest of your troop got out of your foxholes?
What happened was that we formed a diamond formation. That's literally what it was. The shape of it is a diamond. It was the whole platoon. And the leader of the platoon, Francis Gallagher, moved out very quickly to the head of it. And we started across that no man's land. It was still dark. And at the first break of light, we were moving up those rises. And the head of the diamond was already at the top and almost over when the Germans had us with machine guns. They took us with a sweep of machine guns and mortar fire and then rifle fire and grenades. And our platoon lieutenant, Francis Gallagher, was shot within 10 seconds of our ascent of those rises. He was shot through the neck, probably both carotid arteries were destroyed at the same time, and he was gone. The rest of us fell instantly at the against this assault of so many weapons, and I don't know how many died in the first assault, or how many died in the second assault, but the assaults went on for the entire day. And by 6 o'clock, this was 6 in the morning, by 6 in the evening, there were only 3 of us left alive. 2 were wounded, 1 was unwounded, and I was the unwounded one. And I think our survival was based on some kind of luck dealing with the geography of those rises, because we made a small cluster of our own. We were a BAR team. The man I shared the foxhole with and my closest buddy were the BAR team, the Browning automatic rifle, and somehow we were missed. They were shot. They were wounded, but I was not. So and I don't know why, except that I did not move, and I don't even think I breathed for the entire time.
How many men were killed?
I never really got the figure straight, but I would guess it is 37 or 38, maybe even as many as 40.
You survived by playing dead for about 12 hours. The Germans were walking around with guns, picking off people who appeared to be alive but wounded. How did you play dead for that long?
Well, I just want to say that they were not walking around. We never saw the Germans. They stayed in their foxholes, if that's what they were occupying. And they had formed a semicircle into which we had walked. That's exactly what happened. And they surrounded us on three sides. They did not have to appear. They just had us perfectly. And I survived by just... I began to count very, very slowly in order to get my breath slowed down so that I would not be breathing in a normal way. And that's what I did for several hours. And I lay there for 12 hours without moving. And that was it. Hoping, in fact, that I might get a kind of respectable wound that would enable me to concentrate on, you know, a wound in the thigh, the fleshy part of the thigh, or, so that I could concentrate on that and forget about my own anxieties. I had the feeling that if I were wounded, my fear would lift and disappear. I would have gotten it.
What position did you fall in, and how uncomfortable was it to hold that position for the 12 hours?
I was sprawled, not flat, but sort of in that position where you're half on your hip and more on your stomach, with my face really in the mud. It was very muddy and had been raining for days before that. And was not a comfortable position, not a usual position, but there it was. And that's what I stayed with.
My guest is Robert Kotlowitz. His World War II memoir is called Before Their Time. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Robert Kotlowitz. His latest book is a memoir about his experiences in World War II. It's called Before Their Time. As you lay playing dead in the mud, you were listening to your buddies die. What did you hear?
Well, the sounds that I heard were the worst sounds I have ever heard, and I do feel that the sounds of war are the worst part of it. I heard young men screaming in terror and pain, calling for their mothers in some cases, which is the saddest call of all. Some of them speaking in a language I had never heard, including my friend who I shared the foxhole with. He was grunting a kind of animal-like way all day, violently thirsty. I could not get him any water. And those sounds were almost worse than the sounds of the machine gun rounds and the grenades and the mortars and the snipers. It's unbearable to hear people you have trained with for months and months to listen to them die in a helpless way and be unable to give them any help at all.
How did you know when it was safe for you to get up?
Well, dusk had really begun to fall. It was really getting dark. And it quieted down. It really got quieted. And I thought maybe the Germans had pulled back, having won the day. I mean, no question of that. Not that I thought of it that way, but there was no reason for them to stay anymore. And I heard English being spoken, and I listened and listened, and I realized that there were, I think, three medics scouring that rise where we were, looking for survivors so they could take them back to company headquarters and from there to the division hospital. And so I spoke up. I just said, I forget what I said. I don't remember what I said in the book, but I did get the attention of one and finally ended up carrying what they considered to be a wounded soldier back to headquarters, and I knew he was dead. He was dead. And that's how I got out of there.
What was the first scene you saw when you picked your head up out of the mud?
It was a kind of litter of bodies, most of which I knew were dead, and three upright young Americans wearing Red Cross armbands, carrying two stretchers among them.
You must have had such conflicting emotions when you emerged, the exhilaration of having survived and the agony of having lost just about everyone who you trained with.
Well, I was in terrible shock, although part of me was functioning in a very clear way. I mean, I saw everything that I saw, heard everything that I heard, and processed it the way I normally did, but my system was in terrible shock. I no longer was afraid. When I stood up and spoke to the medic and then helped the third medic carry the dead GI back, I was no longer afraid. I mean, it was about 500 yards to company headquarters, and I made that move feeling just, exalted is not the word, but it's not far from it. I think I was running on the last of my adrenaline, and that it was getting me to the end, and that when I got to company headquarters, it sort of vanished again, and I began to shake and tremble and all the things that you do when you're in shock. And that's how I felt when I got out of there.
You were very angry with your commander. Why?
Well, I had the feeling that clearly those orders, I don't know where the orders came from, whether they came from battalion headquarters, regiment, or division, I don't know. But they had not been thought through, and the timing was off, and our company commander was not part of the action. He was 500 yards behind us. We had no help all day. There was no artillery, no artillery fire, no troops sent out to help us. So, of course, I was enraged, and I saw him, too.
Where'd you see him?
He was in his company tent talking on the phone with the company master sergeant in the tent, a major I had never seen before standing there sort of beating his thigh with a stick, his own thigh. And there were company commanders from two adjoining companies there. They were probably discussing a counterattack, and two MPs. And when my company commander saw me, he didn't quite remember my name. He knew it began with a K. And he said, let's get this man a Silver Star. Let's put him in for a Silver Star right away. He had no idea what had happened, what I had done, what my part was. But I could see that he was hysterical. And it was not the first time I had seen him like that. His tendency was to, when he lost control of a situation, when it slipped out of his hands, he got hysterical. And he was hysterical, and I was not far from it myself. And he did this monologue about the afternoon, and I knew, it was just awful to hear it and to see him. And I just said, get me out of here, and I left the tent. And one of the medics was going back with the stretcher with that dead GI on it to the divisional hospital. And I hopped on the Jeep and was off with them.
After the battle, one of the people you were introduced to was an infantry historian whose job it was at that point to write up what happened. in the battle that you survived. Did you get to read his history, and how did it compare to your memory of what you had lived through?
Well, his history, as I found it, was an entry of about three lines in the 26th Infantry Division history of the war. And it was not specific in any way. In fact, you couldn't tell whether anything had really happened or not. So it was useless, absolutely useless to me.
Did you find other references to that battle in other history books?
I found one in the U.S. Army Alsace-Lorraine history, which was a line suggesting there was an action, which was even more meager. And then I found an entry in the 4th Infantry Division of the 26th Division, which acknowledged that something had happened and that it was important to the division because it marked such a serious loss. I later met with a German historian who was a member of the German army in Berlin, and he found for me an entry in one of their daily war reports, which matched the experience in terms of the location and date, which in six lines said that the Panzer Division was attacked by Americans at 6 in the morning, and by 6 in the evening, they had been totally destroyed. And after this lieutenant had translated this for me, he turned to me deadpan and said, "It misses the reality, doesn't it?"
It must have been strange to read the German account, which would be feeling quite good about the demise of...
Well, it was very matter-of-fact, as those day reports tended to be in the Army. It was a way to keep the history of the Army together in brief, you know, presentations. So it was very bald, but it was very clear that that's what it was.
Robert Kotlowitz's World War II memoir, Before Their Time, has just been published in paperback. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. And from Bantam Books, publishers of Antarctica by Kim Stanley Robinson, an adventure novel by the author of Blue Mars, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, trying to make sense of it all, Robert Kotlowitz talks about the psychiatric counseling he received after surviving the battle in which most of his platoon was killed. Then linguist Jeff Nunberg talks about new words like infotainment and rockumentary. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Kotlowitz. His World War II memoir, Before Their Time, has just been published in paperback. It describes his experiences as a college student drafted into the infantry and sent to the French countryside to fight the Germans. He went on to become managing editor of Harper's Magazine and director of broadcasting at the New York public TV station WNET. When we left off, he was telling us about the battle which wiped out most of his platoon. After being one of three men of your platoon to survive this German attack, and the only member of the platoon to survive unwounded, you were sent to an army psychiatrist. Did you feel you wanted or needed one at that point?
Actually, I had no idea, because psychiatry, or whatever the words were such a new concept for me at that time. I knew I wanted to talk to somebody in some serious way, to somebody who would get it, who would understand what I was talking about and what I was saying. If it were with a psychiatrist, that was fine with me. And I certainly had a chance to talk. I mean, I had a chance to tell that story endless numbers of time. I was given sodium pentothal, which was known in those days as a truth serum, which enabled me to tell the story again in exactly the same way, but at least they'd, you know, shot me with their newest medicine. And it was a help to talk to a stranger like that. It really was a help.
Why was it helpful to talk to a stranger?
It was somebody who had no investment in the engagement and only cared about me at that particular time.
Did you want to be sent home for psychiatric reasons or get sent back into the war?
I did not want to be sent home for any reasons, but I did not want to be sent back to the front either. I wanted some kind of war work that I could be part of in an effective way, but I certainly did not want to be an infantryman anymore.
Where were you sent after the psychiatric treatment?
I ultimately, right after the psychiatric treatment, I was sent to a depot in Nancy, which was not far from where we were, in which all the duffel bags of the 26th Infantry Division were stored. And along with three other GIs, we guarded those bags on our own. We sort of ran a little commune there. And that lasted for several weeks. And then ultimately I was transferred to an outfit that did investigating of captured German weapons.
And were these assignments more of what you were hoping for?
Well, they were assignments that got me out of that daily slog and threat, of being killed. It got me out of the infantry. Yes, it did.
The infantry always seems like it's in some ways the worst place to be in a war.
It is. It is because, you know, the Air Force lives a terribly dangerous life, but they do those missions, and if they get back, they get back to a clean bed and a base in which some kind of normal life is going on. If you're in the infantry and you're on the front, your day is 24 hours long, and you're at full attention for 24 hours, even when you're sleeping. And you go out on, if you go out to sit on a night patrol in a foxhole midway between the two lines, you're up all night long listening for what is going on in the enemy lines, trying to make some rational sense out of it. The infantry life is really awful, and it's awful in a physical sense too. I mean, it's very hard to keep yourself in reasonable shape in terms of your clothes, your personal cleanliness, I mean, you name it, everything. It's the toughest life I had ever lived.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Kotlowitz, and he's written a World War II memoir called Before Their Time that's just been published in paperback. Reading your book made me think a little bit of the fact that it must be, in a way, a little bit perilous to be a very introspective man in a war and in a foxhole. I think for people who have... I guess what I'm trying to say is I think the more introspective you are, the more likely to be self-critical you are, the more likely you are perhaps to feel very vulnerable. And that's not really the way you're supposed to be feeling when you're in a war. I think it's probably better to feel kind of invincible and to feel very strong.
Well, yes, I think that's probably correct. And as you can imagine, many of those 175,000 ASDP students who were returned to the infantry were not unlike me. And all my real friends in the Army came from that group, and we shared many emotions, including the sensitivity to fear, the introspection that led us to question our own behavior all the time, the inability to get out of ourselves and just do what had to be done the way some men seem to me clearly able to do. No, I think you're absolutely right.
Now, you're Jewish. You were fighting in the French countryside against the Germans. Your dog tag had an H for Hebrew on it, and you write in your memoir about how you'd lie in your foxhole and wonder, well, should I maybe take these dog tags off? Say I get captured by the Germans, and it says right here, I'm Jewish.
Yes. It was something that, for a short period in combat, worried me. And I thought, you know, would I be, if I were captured, would I go to an ordinary conventional PW camp, or would I be sent to a special camp for Jewish soldiers? And I finally decided my dog tags were the only thing that really identified me, you know, and that I would wear them the way everybody else was wearing them. And then I discovered just a year ago that there actually were those camps in which Jewish soldiers who were captured were sent to do kind of slave labor work. And I had no idea that that really was going on at the time.
Do you think in that sense that the Army made a mistake in identifying your religion on your dog tags?
Well, the identification was really intended for burial purposes. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're going to be killed during the war, the army wanted to bury you in a way that was faithful to your faith, assuming you had a faith. But you had to have some kind of identification. You couldn't say I was an A for atheist. And I think given the time, given 1943, 1944, there was probably no choice in the matter. I mean, soldiers were identified on their dog tags by religion just as they were by their blood type.
Did the war make you any more or less religious?
It certainly did not make me any more religious. It made me, I don't think it changed me in any essential ways, but I do think it made me very alert to my own sense of my life and what I should and how I should live it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I tended far less after this episode and after the whole war to consider compromises in the way I was going to live my life, particularly in the aspects of work.
Well, let me say that before the war you were pre-med. After the war you became a writer and went into broadcasting.
Right. And I was an editor, magazine editor
right.
for years too.
Right.
So
you think,
and those were real choices on my part.
You think you wouldn't have had the courage to choose writing and editing?
Well, I mean, when I was a pre-med, I was a 16-year-old pre-med. I didn't know whether I was coming or going, as the saying used to be, and had no desire to be a doctor, had vague ambitions to be a writer then, and I was living in a very tight, well-organized community in Baltimore, which is not unlike Philadelphia, and I wanted out. I wanted out when I was 16. That I knew.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if there had not been a war, I don't know how I would have resolved my personal life. Because of the war, there was no choice. I went back, finished college on the GI Bill, went to New York, and lived my life.
My guest is Robert Kotlowitz. His World War II memoir is called Before Their Time. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is Robert Kotlowitz, and his latest book is a World War II memoir called Before Their Time. It's just been published in paperback. You know, when we read about war, we usually read about camaraderie, and your book has much about camaraderie, but I believe it also has feelings of alienation that are expressed in it. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that at all, this sense of camaraderie and alienation that you experienced during the war.
Do you mean alienation from my friends, or?
Well, from some of the people in your platoon.
Well, you know, it was my, I had very close friends, and one of whom was one of the wounded ones in the platoon, whom I still see.
Mm-hmm.
But there were other guys in the platoon who were absolutely new to my experience. I mean, people I had never known before, because I had led a very protected life. And it was difficult for me for the first year to even be able to maintain a conversation with these people. I mean, we had one guy, for example, who was okay except for the fact that he liked to steal his pal's underwear when he came back from the laundry. And, you know, we were so self-righteous at 18 and morally driven. And we made a big case out of this until our squad leader said, forget it, it's just clothes, for God's sake. Well, I didn't have that tolerance then.
Mm.
And living with all of these strange, unexpected people from everywhere, living with so many different kinds of religions and beliefs, it was beyond my comprehension for a while. But that certainly created a kind of reservoir of tolerance in me, which enabled me to live with them and has served me, I think, well in my life since.
Now, the publication of your memoir, your book was first published in hardcover a couple of years ago, has just come out in paperback, has coincided with this whole revival of interest in World War II, from Saving Private Ryan to the Tom Brokaw bestseller, The Greatest Generation. And I'm wondering what you make of that revival of interest and the way it's being treated.
Well, I think most of it began on the 50th anniversary of VE Day, which mm-hmm. was about 3 years ago. And I think people began to suddenly be aware that the veterans of World War II were beginning to disappear. I mean, considerably more than half of the men and women who served in the United States Armed Forces in the war are dead. So the real memory of it is going, and I think people are becoming conscious of that. I've had hundreds of letters about this book, and a significant strand of letters comes from the sons of World War II veterans who had died and who had never spoken to their sons about their experiences. And because that's not what you did, it's not what you talked about at the dinner table with your kids. And they're now desperate to try to find out how their parents, how their father lived, what happened to a GI. And some of them are really obsessed by this.
I know you've lectured about the difference between history and memory. What are some of those differences that have been most significant for you? Because I'm sure you've read histories of the war and have also lived with your own memories of it.
Well, when I sat, you know, I wrote this book very late after the event.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure that I was ever going to do it. And the loss of my wife about 5 years ago was one of the impulses in the writing of this book, because I did a piece about the last 4 months of her life. She died of cancer, which appeared in the Sunday Times magazine, and that effort sort of released the energy for this book. And I began to work on it, and I thought, you know, this is my story. This is not a history that could ever be claimed as a chronology of authentic dates and facts. This is what I remember and how I remember it. And there are people who say to me, how did you remember so much after all this time? Well, the real point is how much I have forgotten. I mean, what is in this book is everything that I remember. What I've Forgotten would fill 20 more volumes. But the difference between memory and history is the personal thing. I mean, we remember as individuals. Historians write as though this is the way it was, and there was no two ways about it. Well, it doesn't get the human suffering element. It misses the reality, as that German lieutenant said to me. Most history does.
Robert Kotlowitz, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Robert Kotlowitz is the author of the World War II memoir, Before Their Time. It's just been published in paperback.
I let a song go out of my heart. It was the sweetest melody. I know I lost heaven, 'cause you were the song.
That's Rosemary Clooney, accompanied by the Duke Ellington Orchestra from the album Blue Rose. That 1956 session has just been reissued on CD. It was recorded under unusual circumstances. Clooney, who was at home in Los Angeles, was supposed to go to New York to record with Ellington, but she was in the middle of a difficult pregnancy which prevented her from traveling. So the orchestra recorded the arrangements, sent her the tapes, and she overdubbed the vocals. Ellington also sent band member Billy Strayhorn to work with Clooney. In 1997, at City Arts and Lectures in San Francisco, Rosemary Clooney told me how Billy Strayhorn helped her through this recording.
He was wonderful. He was just wonderful. He would wake me up in the morning, knock on my bedroom door and wake me up, and then come in and say, "Well, now what song do you think we ought to?" And we'd talk, but he'd sit on the edge of the bed, you know, and that's how we planned the album. And then I'd get myself together a little bit and go downstairs to the piano, and then he would get the keys. And then he'd play other renditions for me and say, "Well, I think that you'd be able to do this. Just take this and just learn it and do it the way you would like to." He was responsible. It would not have been possible if it weren't for Billy.
Did he give you any insights into music that were interesting for you? Or about your singing?
No.
Okay.
No, we didn't know. No, I mean, we just didn't talk about it.
Right.
What he would say to me as a director, he would be in the booth. This is after he went back east and recorded and arranged all the arrangements with Duke, and then came back with the tapes under his arm. And then we'd go into the studio for as long as I could make it, you know. And then he would make kind of faces at me through the glass. Or he would say, you know, or direct me in a way that I could understand. Because by that time, we were close friends.
Rosemary Clooney, that 1956 album with the Duke Ellington Orchestra, Blue Rose, has just been reissued on CD. Let's hear a song from it.
Like I love him, no. nobody could. I got it bad, and that ain't good. Though folks with good intentions tell me to save my tears, I'm glad I'm mad about him. I can't live without him. Lord above me, make him love me the way he should. I got it bad, and that ain't good.
Rosemary Clooney and the Duke Ellington Orchestra from the newly reissued album Blue Rose. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on how the media is shaping our language. This is Fresh Air. Cineplex, simulcast, dancer size, frappuccino. What do these words have in common? They're what Lewis Carroll called portmanteau words, new words formed by putting together parts of two other words. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg says the popularity of portmanteau words suggests something about the role of the media in shaping the English language.
In 1811, if you'll cast your mind back, Massachusetts Governor Elbridge Gerry enacted a redistricting of the state that was highly favorable to the Federalist Party. One of the districts was so oddly shaped, in fact, that the painter Gilbert Stuart remarked to a newspaper editor friend that it looked like a salamander and drew a head and claws on the map to bring out the resemblance. More like a gerrymander, said the editor, who published the picture in the next day's edition of the newspaper. That was the origin of the word gerrymander, which somehow acquired a soft G over the course of the following century. It had the distinction of being the first portmanteau word to be coined in America, a word that is formed by blending together the parts of two other words. Actually, it wasn't for another 60 years that the term portmanteau word itself would be invented. Its author was none other than Lewis Carroll, who took it from the name of a large leather suitcase with two hinged compartments. It comes up in Through the Looking Glass, just after Humpty Dumpty has recited Jabberwocky, when he's explaining to Alice how he formed the word slithy out of lithe and slimy. It's like a portmanteau, he says. There are two meanings packed up into one word. At the time Carroll was writing, though, there were only a few portmanteau words in English. Dumbfound was one, formed from dumb plus confound, and so was twirl, formed from twist and swirl. But until the 20th century, this was a decidedly minor way of making new English words. The vogue for portmanteau words really began around the turn of the 20th century, with input from several pretty disparate sources. The Soviets made this a favorite way of forming the names of policies and organizations like Comintern from Communist International and Agitprop from Agitation and Propaganda. The resolutely anti-communist Time magazine was no less creative, coining words like Cinemogul, and so was the columnist Walter Winchell, who coined infanticipating for expecting a child. Most of these examples didn't really catch on, but corporate America was more successful with product names like Pepto-Mint and Dictaphone. And journalist and publicist had a high time coining words like smog from smoke plus fog, motel from motor hotel, and brunch from breakfast plus lunch. The process picked up more steam after the war, and it's been at full throttle in recent years. The entertainment people have given us Cineplex, Blaxploitation, infotainment, dramedy, and rockumentary. Politicians have given us Medicare and Reaganomics. Business people talk about permatemps, infopreneurs, and co-opetition. Technology is full of these words, simulcast, netiquette, cybernaut, emoticon, and all the other terms popular among the people that we call the digerati. There's no escaping them, even in daily life. Hey, after we finish our dancer size, why don't we slip out of our tankinis and go out for a frappuccino? Fantabulous. In the past few generations, English has introduced more portmanteau words than in all the previous generations going back to Chaucer. And this doesn't take into consideration all of the portmanteau corporate names that seem to make up half the stocks on the tech indexes. Microsoft, Trinitech, Unisys, Metricom, Infoseek, Logitech. There are naming consultants who have programs that can grind out endless lists of these things. Why have people given us this pullulation of portmanteaus? In the words of the old punchline, because they can. Since the time that newspaper editor came up with gerrymander, most successful portmanteau words have been coined by journalists, press agents, government agencies, corporations, people with the power to broadcast their coinings via the full apparatus of modern publicity. What better way to signal your influence than by putting a stamp on the language itself? This helps to explain why portmanteau words are usually so transparent. In this sense, they're the opposite of slang, which percolates into the language from cliques and in-groups, and which is usually designed to be opaque to people who aren't in the know. You hear some Gen Y person saying, "Wow, that's whack." You have no idea whether the word means good, bad, or expensive. But dancer size, simulcast, frappuccino, they wear their meanings on their shortened sleeves. Portmanteau words are the sound bites of modern English, calculated to catch on the first time people hear them. And their popularity is an indication of just how much influence the media have had on the language over the last 100 years. I open a newspaper or drive down the freeway, and the word shagadelic is staring out at me wherever I look. I guess it's a fitting linguistic note to end the century on.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Little Brown & Company, publishers of The Miracle of Castel di Sangro by Joe McGinnis, in hardcover wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our TV critic David Bianculli talks with Tom Fontana. Fontana co-created the TV series Oz and Homicide and wrote for St. Elsewhere. Join us for the next Fresh Air.